Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hey, I'm Richard Gordon, and welcome to Forbes Avenue, where we are joined today by Annie Carnes, the Senior Marketing Communications and Development Manager of the Light of Life Rescue Mission. Thanks so much for joining us, Annie.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
I was raised in the city of St. Louis, so I can remember all these urban development projects that would come along and things would be condemned by eminent domain and people would be moved out of their houses. And one of the results was homelessness.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of, at least since COVID and the pandemic, there's been a lot of movement around terms like urban redevelopment, eminent domain, and just in general, how it affects homelessness. Of course, we know that it causes displacement of our low-income, you know, residents in Pittsburgh. It causes gentrification issues due to the rent increasing. And the biggest one that we've seen is just, in general, the loss of affordable housing. You know, new developments tending to be, of course, higher costing, pricing out people that have been living in their neighborhoods for decades. So it's just overall increasing housing insecurity. And something that we talk about often at Light of Life are those just reasons why someone becomes homeless to begin with. You know, we serve over 3,000 unique individuals every year just through our emergency shelter, those that are experiencing homelessness. And all of them have unique stories. You know, some of them, their stories, you know, are an outcome of things like urban redevelopment. You know, they lost their homes because either the economy or these corporations or investors from other cities have found that Pittsburgh is also a good place to call home. You know, more of what Pittsburgh used to be considered an affordable city to live in is becoming less and less. One of the statistics that we use here at the Mission, we know that the city of Pittsburgh is lacking around 40,000 affordable homes for low-income individuals. The statistic is from the National Authority of Housing Coalition. There is an extreme lack of affordable housing for those that are considered low-income renters. And, you know, it's kind of a new thing for Pittsburgh. You know, people tend to focus on cities like Sacramento or Denver, Washington, D.C., some of these larger cities that have always been known for affordable housing crisis.
But it's not just the housing. There are all sorts of issues that can lead someone to become unhoused or homeless.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, big ones that we mention, of course, mental health, which, it plays into those that have issues with addiction, and then addiction that plays into issues with people that have mental health. You know, they kind of play off one another. And those are two big ones. And the other one that sort of, you know, stemmed from the pandemic era were people that, you know, lost their jobs during COVID, the economic factors and inflation that have happened over the last 4 years or so. Those are also two big ones, besides, you know, mental health and addiction issues. And then the other one is the affordable housing. So we talk often about those as specific reasons why people become homeless. But, you know, when you sit down and talk to some of the guests that come in and out of the shelter, they all have different stories. And sometimes they don't always align with those top three or four ones that I've just mentioned. Some of their stories would shock you, which is why we always say anybody can become homeless at any point in their lives. It just takes one significant event to happen in an individual's life. You know, your husband, who maybe he's the breadwinner of the family, he has now gotten diagnosed with cancer. Your house catches on fire and now you're displaced. We also know the city of Pittsburgh sees 1,200 individuals were evicted from their homes in the month of January, which we know to have been one of the coldest months and the coldest winters that Pittsburgh has seen in over a decade. So imagine families, you know, not people who have just been displaced because of issues with mental health or addiction. They lost their homes. They were evicted. So that is averaging 40 families a night in the city of Pittsburgh who were evicted, some out on the streets in the bitter cold, others maybe couch surfing among family members. And these are real numbers. You know, this is real life.
I've only lived in Pittsburgh for about 6 years. As I drive down Route 65 or get off 28 to go on the 31st Street Bridge, you always see these people standing there panhandling.
Yeah.
And I feel there, but for the grace of God, I could be there.
Yeah, listen, I'm glad you brought up the panhandling because there's misconceptions, right? You know, people who work within the city limits of Pittsburgh, you know, not just out in the suburbs, maybe they live in the suburbs and they're crossing the 16th Street Bridge. They're getting up on 279. They're about to go through the Fort Pitt tunnels. You know, there's people, there's panhandlers at each of these areas consistently, you know, during your daily commute. And I want to share two things. The first thing is big question. What do you do if you come across someone panhandling? Do you give them money? Do you roll down your window? People have different opinions that can swing one way or the other. And something that we try to educate people on is if you are approached by a panhandler, do not give them money. That could be the last $5 they ever spend. We hear stories about people who were given, you know, $5, $10, a dollar. And if they do have alcohol or drug issues, unfortunately, most of the time, that's what they're going to spend their money on. And the last thing that we want is another overdose. So what we suggest is keep some bottles of water in your car in the summer. Keep some hand warmers in your car in the winter. We have something called Hope and Help cards that we have here at the Mission. People are more than welcome to stop by at our Ridge Recovery Place building and pick them up, you know, especially if you're kind of like a daily commuter. And what they are, they list our services, our meal times, more information about our shelter. We're trying to encourage more and more people that light of life. We're here to help. We exist. And those that are, you know, just out on their daily commute and they come across somebody and they feel pressured to give money, give them a granola bar instead. Hand them a Hope and Help card. The second thing that I wanted to mention was for those that are passing the homeless, you know, that are visible out on the street or passing a panhandler. And, you know, for those that aren't familiar with just the homeless population in general, there may be some judgment or some bias. You know, oh, why doesn't that person just get a job? Or, you know, why does that person just go to the shelter and get help? And one of the stories that puts things into perspective a little bit, that not that we like to share it, but because it's so unfortunate and sad, it's just one of those things that makes you think differently. You may know, but Light of Life has a street outreach team, and our team goes out to different encampments around the city every single day. You know, we hit up different encampments throughout the week, and we try to bring them, those that are living in the tents or sleeping on porch stoops, resources. You know, we'll bring them hygiene kits, water. We will drive them back to the shelter so they can get a hot meal, a shower, learn more about what Light of Life offers to help them get off the street. And our street outreach team, there was a gentleman who was just sleeping a few doors down on the stoop of an abandoned building right next to our North Avenue shelter. And our outreach team would go to him almost every day, you know, hey, you know, can you come back? I think his name was Roger. Roger, you want to come back to get a meal? You want shelter? You know, we were offering as much as we possibly could to get him from, you know, keeping from sleeping on the stoop. And, you know, these people that are homeless, not only have they experienced some kind of trauma to get them there, but homelessness in general is so difficult. So they're experiencing even more trauma by sleeping out on the street, not knowing where their next meal is coming from, and then also being vulnerable to the drugs that are out there, and then, of course, harsh weather conditions. It's not like people are desiring always to be out there. So our outreach team would visit Roger to build up this relationship and rapport and just trust with him. It took about a year before this man decided to get up off the stoop and come into our North Avenue shelter for a meal. And that happens often. It takes a long time to build up trust because some of our homeless have just been burned in the past by trusting other people, organizations, or whatever their story is. And after our outreach team had built up that trust with him, you know, they had asked, do you mind telling us, how did you get here? You know, how did you get into your homeless situation? And, you know, we learned then that the real reason that Roger was not coming into our North Avenue shelter wasn't because he was refusing services. He had developed a mental health condition because of a life situation that he went through 3 years prior, where his house burned down and he was the only member of his family that survived.
Oh my God.
So his wife, his children, they perished in the fire, and his mental state basically had convinced him that he was unworthy of walking into another building because his family never had the option to walk out of one. And in his mind, he believed that he was no longer worthy of having a home, of accepting love, or walking into a building because he had developed a fear of walking out. You know, and so when you passed Roger on the street on your way home in your car, and you know, just a normal person, normal Pittsburgher, normal daily commuter, seeing him a few blocks away from a shelter, mind you, thinking that person just doesn't want to get a job. That person doesn't want any help. You know, this is the homeless cause this for themselves. They could get help. These are stories that we hear every day. And everyone's story, you know, is different, of course, but it really puts things into perspective when you meet people like Roger and you realize, and I turn it around to the people listening, what would you do? I mean, I don't know what I would do if I lost my kids and husband in a fire. I would go crazy. So you have to ask yourself, does that person have more to their story? And, you know, 99.9% of the time, that answer is yes.
We are talking with Annie Carnes of the Light of Life Rescue Mission. And I know that the Light of Life Rescue Mission and Northside Common Ministries and food banks, there are lots of agencies in Pittsburgh that are available to help those who are unhoused or homeless. Where are you actually located? What, you've got the mission on North Avenue, but that's got a special purpose, but I think you've got others as well.
Oh, yes. I mean, you know, a little bit of background for those that may have never even heard of Light of Life Rescue Mission. We have been on the north side of Pittsburgh for over 70 years, serving the homeless and hurting on Pittsburgh's north side. And we started actually as a soup kitchen on the north side. Then they opened it up to emergency shelter for just men after they had been basically saying, like, okay, let's get some long-term programming in here. So we went from soup kitchen to long-term programming for men, holding things like AA and NA, and then we opened up emergency shelter for men. But, you know, fast forward to today, we are actually no longer at the North Avenue shelter. As of last year, or the tail end of 2023, we opened up a brand new facility called Ridge Recovery Place. And it's on the north side. It was actually the old Allegheny High School vocational tech building next to the CCAC campus on the north side. Huge building. That is where we house all of our long-term programming for men, women, and children. And that's where our donation center is, where our administrative offices are. And that building is in addition to the emergency shelter that we opened up in 2021 called Vetley Street Shelter, which is more on the North Shore along River Avenue there. And that is where we have all of our emergency services, you know, hot meals for the homeless. People can come in and get resources, help with obtaining their IDs, which we know is a big barrier for people getting jobs and housing. So that houses all of our emergency services. Just recently, over the last few weeks, we announced that we have now officially partnered with another nonprofit called Off the Floor Pittsburgh. We have always been known for emergency services, you know, hot meals, hot showers, shelter, that sort of thing. And then we started getting into long-term programming years and years back, opened up long-term programming for women and children. But there's been this gap, or lack of focus, I guess is the best word, for people that are on the brink of homelessness. You know, these are the people that are just one paycheck away from losing their home. And they probably are considered in that eviction number that I mentioned earlier, that 1,200 people a month. And so Light of Life had started developing more services, such as our donation center, our food pantry. We have something called a free store. And these services are to help people either on the brink of homelessness so that they can focus on just paying their rent. You know, they don't have to worry about buying clothes for their kids because they can, you know, get it at the free store or the donation center. They don't have to worry about groceries because they can buy free food at the food pantry. They don't have to worry about buying groceries. And so one of the other gaps was furniture. Let's say you were homeless at one point and you went through our programs, or maybe you went through another program and now you're getting housing for the first time. You got to worry about furnishing your place, right? You don't want your kids sleeping on the floor. So that's where now we have a new ministry, or an additional ministry, I suppose, called Off the Floor Pittsburgh. So now we help people with furniture needs, which is really exciting.
In what you were saying, there are several really important pieces here. It's not just you're homeless, here's a bed to sleep in and a meal. It's also how can we help you find a home.
Right, right. And, you know, there's other agencies other than Light of Life. You know, we work with a lot of partners. You know, our donation center alone has 50 partnering organizations. So the people that they're serving can come in, you know, to our donation center and get clothing. And people in our food pantry, same thing. We've got 35, 40 partnering organizations for our food pantry. So now these organizations are coming in and getting food in bulk for the people that and the families that they serve. We all know that, you know, Department of Human Services for the county, they are the main sort of like entry point to get on the list for housing. They use something called Allegheny Link. Mm-hmm. And in our opinion, one of the gaps with the Allegheny Link system is you have to become homeless first before you get on that list. So, and, you know, if you are somebody who's on the brink of homelessness and you know, hey, you're getting evicted next month, it's harder to get housing, and the list is so long that those people that are waiting are the ones that are, you know, staying at Light of Life, Bethlehem Haven, or other, you know, partnering shelters that can give them temporary housing. And, you know, it just takes longer to get that housing that they need.
Now, I go to church on the north side, and I ride the 16 bus into downtown. So I go down, you know, Brighton House Road, and there's Northside Common Ministries, and I walk past, you know, where your North Avenue mission used to be. I think it's really important for people to know that you're not the only place in town that's helping people.
Yeah, yeah, and we all talk to each other, you know, and we're getting better at talking to one another. You know, all these partnering agencies, especially during the harsh winter months, there's like a big email that goes out and basically says, here's all the open beds that, you know, we have open for the day. Here's all the open beds that the other person has open for the day. And
oh, very good. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that that's super helpful, because what happens is, this is a big question we get, you know, it's 5 degrees outside and somebody walks into Light of Life shelter, let's say at midnight, they're looking for a place to stay. We, of course, have opened something called overflow shelter, because our normal emergency shelter is always full in the winter. And the last thing we want is to send somebody back out on the street, which we don't do. we really exhaust every effort to make sure that they get a bed to stay in somewhere. So, you know, if our shelter's full, we'll go ahead and call East End Cooperative Ministry, you know, say, hey, what's your bed situation look like right now? Now, luckily, the county's opened up the McNocker shelter for their winter plan, so that it's, you know, the ultimate low barrier shelter situation, just to make sure people are getting off the street during the winter. This year's communication amongst providers has improved drastically since last year. I will say that much. So I think it's just continuing that communication with each other. And then there's all these ideas that float around. Well, how can we make it better? How can we make sure that the homeless know where to go? And that's where street outreach teams come in. You know, we've got Light of Life street outreach team, And then, of course, Pittsburgh Mercy's Operation Safety Net. They have their street outreach team. There are multiple organizations that have teams that go out to the encampments and say, hey, you know, here's a list of places that you can go tonight. Do you need a ride there? So there are systems in place. I think that overall, anything and everything could always improve. And it's a matter of having those resources to have more people be going out and talking to the homeless within their encampments and their tents and, you know, getting them either into a shelter, which sometimes they're hesitant on doing because they got to leave all their, you know, a lot of their stuff in their tents. They come back the next day. It's stolen. You know, everything's gone. So there are people that will choose to stay out in their tents instead of coming into a shelter for one reason or another. You got addiction issues. You got mental health. You have people who are staying in tents who believe that they don't need help at all because their mental health condition is so severe that it's really heartbreaking because you can't convince them that they need help. And, you know, we say it all the time at Light of Life, we need more supportive programming for people with severe mental health. You know, even you know, they'll walk into Light of Life, we will call Western Psych, and then they'll go to Western Psych, they'll get admitted, and then they get discharged in less than a day, and then they're back out on the street. There is a huge mental health capacity. There's a gap there that we really need to start focusing on.
We're talking with Annie Carnes from the Light of Life Rescue Mission, one of the many agencies and shelters that is available to help the homeless here in Pittsburgh. A client comes in and needs a place to stay, needs food, and needs training, needs help with getting their act together enough to be able to deal with an apartment again. Mm-hmm. What are all the kinds of things that you do at Light of Life? Because I imagine that's very similar to what some of the other agencies do as well.
There's certainly a process. You know, you walk in, you seek help. And like I mentioned earlier, everyone's story is different, right? Like everybody has a different story and a unique situation that got them in that spot to begin with, which means, guess what? They're going to need a unique solution to right. help them and get them out of that. So we do an intake. We get to know their story. We have to understand where they came from. How long have they been homeless? Because we know if you've been homeless for, you know, 3 days versus 3 years, that's, you know, you get more trauma the longer right. that you're out there being homeless. So we do an intake. We understand and assess their needs. We have partnered with AHN and Northside Health, the mental health of the Northside. And they actually have staff on site every day, Light of Life. And if they have mental health issues or they need something other health related, we connect them with the counselors on site. We also have people who have jobs and they're homeless. They just can't make enough money to make ends meet to put, for instance, like a down payment on rent, or they may have like lost all their money through a divorce. Like you just don't know their situation, right? They're working, they're going to work and they're coming and they are sleeping at our shelter and going back to work. And a lot of the times there's that embarrassment that comes along with it where the people they work with have no idea that they're homeless and they're staying at our shelter. So we have a special designated program at Light of Life at the emergency shelter, as well as the long-term programs building. At the emergency shelter, we call it Shelter Plus. We have 12 beds for men who, for instance, have jobs and they're just staying at Light of Life. And then High Commitment Shelter, you know, you could stay with us, I think, up to a year for the High Commitment Shelter. We have finance classes for them as well so that they can learn to, you know, save their money appropriately so they can get out of their situation and get them back up on their feet. We also have a mental health program as well as a life recovery program. So if you're dealing with your mental health issues, there's a place for you at Ridge Recovery Place. If you have addiction issues, there's a place for you at Ridge Recovery Place. And then for women and children, same thing. We have a women and children's long-term program. You know, these programs can last up to 2 years or longer, where you live with us at Light of Life for that long. For women and children, the program looks different because they have different needs because children are involved. And oftentimes women who have been through either the homeless system, the shelter system, have gone through addiction, they have either sort of severed the relationship with their children, or, you know, it just doesn't look like a healthy situation. So as a part of their program, we help them get back on this sort of like family mentality and help them build back the relationship with their kids. And so the kids go through our program too, because that means that they're getting the support that they need as well. You know, we partner with the Homeless Children's Education Fund. They help with sort of making sure kids aren't falling behind on the school side if we have a woman in the program. So we have so many options. You know, our street outreach team, we have a day center. The outreach team members, not only do they go to the tents, but if somebody comes into the day center and they're like, hey, you know, I can't get a job. Okay, well, do you have an ID so you can apply for a job? Well, no. Okay, let's go to the DMV. We drive them to the DMV, the Social Security office. We get them their birth certificate. Any barrier that keeps this human being from getting back up on their feet, getting a job, getting housing. We have people that come in who just like, they want a job, they don't want to become homeless, and they're back up on their feet relatively quickly. And then we have people come in, they stay at our emergency shelter, and then finally they make the decision, I don't want to live like this anymore. I want to change my life. And then they go into our long-term programs, and then they graduate, and then they get into transitional housing and then permanent housing, and they become alumni. Some of them are now on staff at Light of Life, which is like the best ever, because
they're role models.
Yes, exactly.
Annie Carnes is so glad that there are agencies like Light of Life Rescue Mission in Pittsburgh to help people. Now, I feel like Light of Life, Northside Common Ministries, all the other private rescue missions are filling in a gap that's not provided for by state, federal, or county government.
Yes. Yeah. Light of Life is funded primarily by private donors, you know, and we have such dedicated donors. And for us, you know, since we haven't been relying so heavily on government funding to do what we do, you know, we are one of the fortunate organizations that doesn't have to necessarily worry about us having to close our doors, because we have such faithful donors, volunteers, you name it. And we couldn't do what we do without our volunteers. But it's a hard subject to talk about, because unlike other cities, you know, nationwide, we truly believe that there is hope for Pittsburgh. We think we are a small enough city, even though the homeless situation has increased dramatically for the city of Pittsburgh over the last 5 years and it's become more visible, we still believe that this is fixable. You know, like we are small enough, and we have so many great organizations and nonprofits, and for the most part, you know, a county and a city willing to start having these conversations with us as providers to come up with solutions, that we know that change is possible for our city. Our county here in Pittsburgh and our city, I feel like they're leaving all ideas on the table, and they really are trying to find solutions that work, you know, and they could jump the gun and start building tiny homes, which we think isn't that great of an idea, not without wraparound services, but they're not doing that. They're listening to the providers, and we want to keep that conversation going. So I really think recently it's been more of a positive spin, let's just say that much, on how Pittsburgh can get out of this.
What can regular citizens do to help the homeless here in Pittsburgh?
You can educate yourself, truly, you know, on learning how someone becomes homeless to begin with, not passing that judgmental bias that you may have towards homeless people. I think that's a great start. You don't always understand people's stories or how they got there. And of course, I would be remiss without saying, Donate to an organization like Light of Life or like another nonprofit that is directly serving the homeless and trying to get them help out of their situation. The other thing you could do is, you know, if you are someone who has more time than money, volunteer. Light of Life, we can't do anything without our volunteers. They are truly the heart of the mission, and we have so many volunteers. I think we clocked in 16,000 volunteer hours last year. Yeah, so literally, we can't do what we do without our volunteers. Those are the biggest things, right? Just finding out where you can give back and how.
Penny Carnes, this has been absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us on Forbes Avenue.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Anytime that we can get to talk about the Pittsburgh homeless situation and educate people, we're all for it.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hi, I'm Richard Gordon, and welcome to Forbes Avenue here on WRCT Pittsburgh. On May 7th of 2024, I had the privilege of interviewing bassist Ron Carter, right around the time he turned 87 years old. And before I share the conversation we had, let's play a number from his catalog. This is from a 2006 record where he collaborated with guitarist Bill Frisell and drummer Paul Motion. And it's a trio version of a song that Ron Carter wrote with Miles Davis called 81.
What a privilege it is to have Ron Carter on the phone with us here on Forbes Avenue. And what you just heard was Ron Carter, Bill Frisell, and Paul Motion playing 81. Thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Carter.
Good morning to you and yours.
I think that track is really interesting because it's something you co-wrote with Miles Davis, but it comes out totally different in a trio format with Bill Frisell and Paul Motion.
You know, I miss Paul. Paul was a wonderful drummer. He knew melodies, he knew form, he knew dynamics, he knew how to listen. And boy, drum world misses a wonderful influence on them as he's left the scene. It's always fun to play Bill. It's always fun to hear him. And I try to do that whenever I can to see what I missed last time working with him. a good band.
One thing that's fascinating to me about all of Bill Frisell's work and for you too is balancing that written music against the improvisation.
Well, I think two things, Mr. Gordon. We've kind of gotten used to leaving our ego at home, one, and two, bringing both ears to the gig. And if you have that combination, you find nice things to do.
You've played in large groups and led large groups and small groups. You've been in over 2,200 recording dates. What kinds of things stand out to you over the years of experience?
I'm always surprised that the calls I get that are not necessarily jazz bands or jazz-oriented gigs, after all the choices that they have, they decide that this guy, me, has the best chance of making their music do something that they hope it can do. All the good players come to New York. That's what we're all about here. And with the travel situation being what it is, it's easy to get to New York in a moment's notice. So that they have chosen me for their projects as a tribute to recorded sounds and social media and stuff like that. But one of the things I've taken away from these concert projects is that we all got the same notes. Mm-hmm. We just find different orders for them, and I try to find them as quickly as I can for the various projects. It's fun to do that.
I get the sense that you're really adept at both leading the gang and being a supportive team member.
Well, you know, I think quietly, Richard, the band's bass player is both of those. He's always the band leader, and he always leads the charge, so to speak. You know, in any group, Richard, he's the only person, he or she, sorry, ladies, they are the only ones who play every note all the time. Mm-hmm. That means they control the tempo, they control the changes, they determine where the beat is, they determine the pitch of the band, they determine sometimes the volume of the band. He or she is the only one that does each note, has this kind of effect. And I think once we understand that plural we are able to have even more fun going to work night in and night out, which is why I go to work every night. I like those challenges.
You're 87 years old, and you're still performing and still practicing.
Absolutely. Well, my birthday was May 4. I had some nice friends over to say hello, and I'm glad to see you make it this far, given the world. Well, you know, I can't get better, Richard, unless I'm practicing what I'm aiming for. My general practice plan is I go into my practice room, and I have a goal in mind. What can I learn today playing these etudes that I didn't see yesterday? If I can cover that kind of ground and make up for those kind of missteps, so to speak, I'm really ready to go to work tomorrow night because I really figured out something to do that didn't occur to me the night before.
When you're working on your etudes, I mean, they are divorced from the music you're going to play.
Yeah, but it's still the same notes. They're just in different order, man.
So it's all about getting the tools in those fingers so that when your ears hear what the other guys are doing, you know what to pull out.
I want to be all over it. Absolutely correct.
We are chatting with Mr. Ron Carter. And Pittsburgh, the home of our radio station, WRCT, is a great jazz tradition. I think of musicians like Dwayne Dolphin and Roger Humphreys and George Benson and Ray Brown, Billy Storen, Eric Blakey, David Eisenzahn, and many more. What kinds of memories do you have about either collaborating with Pittsburgh musicians or coming to town to play?
One thing, I miss seeing Dwayne often. If you see him again or talk with him, give him my fondest regards and tell him I miss him.
All right.
Several of my school buddies from Eastern School of Music lived in Pittsburgh. At one of our summer breaks, I drove from Rochester to Pittsburgh to pick him up and drive back to school. We had hung out for a weekend. 58 or so. Bill Motzing, a trombone player from Pittsburgh, really played really well and wrote nice arrangements. My other view of Pittsburgh is the jazz club that they had there. What's the name of that place?
Was it the Grill?
Yes, Crawford Grill. Back in the day, they had a knowledgeable jazz crowd. They came and have a good time, but hear the music. They always wore the latest fashions. It was like been in New York, only in Pittsburgh. Loved it.
Well, there's still quite a bit of jazz being played in Pittsburgh, and there's even a church that has jazz vesper service every month. Yeah, it's really cool.
I miss Nathan Davis, too, by the way. He was one of my friends from doing the clinics up there for summers. He was promoting the jazz community's music in and around the city. Lovely man. I'm sorry he's left the concert.
What is different for you about playing for a live audience, whether a club or a concert, or going into a recording session?
I guess three main things. The level of sound that's necessary, no matter how good the club is and how good their system is, the studio requires less physical effort to make the sound of the instrument, in this case bass, fill the room space. Mm-hmm. Secondly, given the quality of microphones and as engineers are learning to record the instrument music better, you needn't play so hard and so forcefully, literally, mm-hmm. for the duration of the gig in the studio as you would have to do in a nightclub. And thirdly, generally speaking, you're in a smaller spectator space. Generally, only the band is at the recording studio, so there's no other views or impressions you want to leave on somebody else who's not playing vis-a-vis the audience. In the studio, you're referring to and relaying to the members of the band, the producer, perhaps, an engineer. So your focus is limited to 5 or 6 people, and it's a lot easier to control that than having your view, your emotional view, your physical view, spread out over a huge room with 2,000 fans.
Has it been your experience that it's easier for the musicians to communicate with each other in a recording session?
Depends on the gear of the studio. Sometimes they have good earphone sets. Sometimes they're prepared to not have any at all. It varies on the situation.
As an amateur bassist myself, I know how important it is to listen and to be able to hear everybody so that, as you say, you can set the pace for them, but also support them in whatever they're doing.
Well, I think a footnote to that, Richard, is that it's important for them to hear me, in this case, me, the bass player.
Right.
Each note I play, and sometimes studios are not geared for that level of bass sounds and notes available to the guys in the band. I've seen some pictures recently of a studio, when a quintet was playing in the studio, and they had everyone in the same room. And I think that's not going to be, that can't be productive for the bass player, because given the space they're living with or playing with, no one in this group, no matter how quiet they play, can hear every note he or she plays.
Right.
I kind of demand that, you know, and I know that that situation that they're in right there moment, that's not going to happen. I don't mind note to go to waste. I think it's impactful for all those reasons I mentioned earlier about each note that I played does those things, and I think that they're doing a disservice to the bass player and his musicians when they are unable to not literally hear every note he or she plays.
Sounds to me like you sort of favor the setup where the bass player is in a separate room but with a glass to see the other players.
Yes, and I don't know how much time you have, but I'll tell you exactly why I feel that way. In an open space where the bass player is in the middle of a room with no barriers around him, stacks of glass, the bass tries to fill all the space around it. Mm-hmm. However big the space is, the bass sound fills that whole area. By the time it gets to the microphone, the sound is so diluted because it's been played, it's been ringing around in this room for all this square footage, that the sound cannot be as impactful or as startling and sounding because the sound is delayed, it's decayed, it's dying by the force of the sound. By the time the force of the sound gets to the microphone, whatever quality it is. And I think to have the bass player more isolated in the room, that's a 6x6 room, it forces the sound of the bass, all of the sound, into the microphone that's now only 2 feet away rather than 25 feet away according to the room. No, I'm not a fan of that at all.
That makes good sense. So you always work with a microphone, or do you, when you play live, do you sometimes work through a pickup?
All those factors are varied. Generally, I have a pickup from David Gage in New York, yeah. A realist, that works really good for me. And the microphones, depending on where it's placed, depending on how close I am to the drums, depending on whether the piano lid is up all the way or halfway, mm-hmm. all those sounds are feeding to my microphone. Mm-hmm. And as a bass is only one instrument times four, or whatever size the quintet is, that microphone cannot possibly isolate enough from everyone else's sounds for the bass sound to be more present in his microphone, quote-unquote, his.
We are chatting with Ron Carter, and bassists out there, you're getting a lot of good tips here from Mr. Carter. As a teenager, I know that you switched from classical music to jazz, and I know that you also made a change from cello to bass, and my sense is that the jazz world is much more about can you play rather than are you from the right side of the street or the preferred race. Have you found that that's true, that the jazz community is more welcoming of more kinds of people?
That was the case back in the day. But I think if you take photographs of orchestras, classical orchestras, mm-hmm. let's say the big top five orchestras, mm-hmm. from 1957 to 2024, I think you will see that the proportion of minorities, people of color, the proportion of graduates from classical schools, and the proportion of them in classical orchestras is not much better in that 30 or 40 year span.
Right.
When I was coming up, it was made pretty clear to me that orchestras, while no matter how good I played, the management was not prepared to hire a person of color in those orchestras back then. And my position is, I'm not sure that much of that has changed given the photographs you found on the internet. So having discouraged is a pretty strong word, but that's probably what it really was. A career in playing classical music, the jazz community welcomed me to New York to try to come to New York because all the players end up there. So there I was. I have not forsaken classical music. And if you didn't know my library, I've recorded some jazz classical mm-hmm. songs and other. Have a nice classical music library in my home of discs and music. I'm still aware of the music, and I will try to play it whenever I get the opportunity to. Every Christmas, for example, mm-hmm. High school orchestras and church orchestras need the extra bass players to play the handle, the Hallelujah Chorus, or mm-hmm. they may have a Brandenburg Society that needs bass players during the course of the holidays. I'm always available to those concert groups, and I play as many as I can as my schedule allows and the availability of them. So I have not forsaken them. I still encourage the music. I can endorse anyone who wants to play that. Go ahead and get your feet wet and enjoy what it does for you. I'm the jazz player in the meantime.
That classical background, I'm sure, has influenced the way you approach practicing and the way you approach performing.
Well, I think the biggest influence for me was how to practice. Back then, the competition as a 14-year-old, 15-year-old was stunning. Of all the good players who were already ahead of me in background and experience, and know that I could kind of make those being the big steps so far ahead of me, not so far back, and kind of even the score, was to know what I had to learn during each practice time. So before I sat down to my cello at the time, I'd figure out what do I need to make this practice time allow me to do with more ease, or a new fingering, or better intonation, a better sound. And when my practice time was over at 2 or 3 hours, I'd stop and say, now, what did I learn this past two and a half hours, or whatever it was? Can I remember what that was and translate that to the next practice time the next day? I still had that mindset, Richard.
That's one of the many things that you'd like to share with other musicians. I mean, all these...
Absolutely.
All this knowledge and experiences, and I know you want to help us all learn from your experiences. So you've got a lot of information up at the Ron Carter Library at roncarterjazz.com.
Yeah, well, you know, one of my concerns, Richard, and this is my concern day, I guess, is that the most books that the jazz bass player is studying are built on playing, in this case, bass horizontally and as fast and as rhythmically and clean as possible. And I certainly admire that concept. My books are different than that. I try to teach my students to play as horizontally as possible across the bass, and my exercises are based on chords. Mm-hmm. My feeling, Richard, is that once the student understands harmony and what the chords sound like and what direction the chords are headed, what's the point of this chord going from this chord to this chord, they see the result of that, they'll play the music differently because they understand the harmony behind the influence of these notes being what they are.
That's a very, very good point. And again, folks, you can find that information about the Ron Carter Library at roncarterjazz.com.
All right.
Now, Ron Carter, you are one of my favorite bassists. I think I told your people that you and Charlie Hayden and Slam Stewart and Dave Holland are probably my favorite bassists.
Well, great. I'm in good company.
But you have also been an integral part of some of my favorite jazz recordings, you know, the Herbie Hancock sessions with Cantaloupe Island and Maiden Voyage and so much great work with Miles. But I still love your work in the trios. And one of my absolute favorites is that old record you made, Jazz My Romance, with Kenny Barron and Herb Ellis.
But, you know, I've always wanted to play with Herbie. I've known him for a very long time because I'm an Oscar Peterson fan. And, of course, Ray Brown and Ed Thigpen, he joined the band. And I said, well, my record contract list lasts two more records. I've got to get Herbie on a record, Herbie Ellis. And Kenny Barron was available at the time my schedule opened up, and I was trumping on a bit to try to track down Herbie Ellis and where he was and could he make this record with him. Well, we had such a great fun. He's just a wonderful guy. You know, wonderful sound of the rhythm he used to play. Just a killer. And I wouldn't trade that for anything.
Thank you so much for your time, Mr. Carter.
Rich, good to talk to you. And I'm sure I'll see you in Pittsburgh. Forget to say hello.
And we're going to let the folks hear Sweet Lorraine from that very record, Jazz My Romance.
And please enjoy Kenny Barron. What a diamond he is. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh.
Whenever I'm in Pittsburgh, which is always because I'm omnipresent, I listen to every radio station at the same time, including